Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A nationwide survey conducted by UC Davis gauged the views and willingness to engage in political violence. Researchers said the findings exceeded their worst expectations. The survey, which is yet to be peer-reviewed, also reveals an escalating level of mistrust in American democracy. But within this grim landscape is the groundwork for hope. To get a better understanding of what this research means, I spoke with Dr. Garen Wintemute, director of the California Firearm Violence Research Center and Violence Prevention Program at UC Davis. Garen, you know, I have interviewed you several times over the past 5 years or so. You're a former emergency room physician in Sacramento that led you to study violence and gun violence research. When I read your headline or the headline for your latest survey, I wasn't surprised by the headline. However, despite that, reading the specific findings was incredibly surprising.
Yes. Sort of parallel train of thought. I had done some preliminary research last year and came away realizing that lots of important questions had not been answered. So we deliberately repeated questions that had been asked before to set the foundation for new material. So some of what you read, you have basically read before, although it's been refreshed. But the information on the specifics of engaging in political violence under particular circumstances, willingness to do it personally, details about targets and lethality, that's all new.
Yeah, there were some that I literally, while reading it, I had to say it out loud because they were particularly more striking. I mean, one was preferring a strong leader versus a democracy. You have 42% or so agreeing that having a strong leader for America is more important than having a democracy. What led to the language for that survey question?
Yeah, I drafted that language, I can tell you. I had been looking, our group had been looking at the questions that had been asked before and decided we, here and in other places, we needed to push it. We needed to ask people to make a concrete choice. And the statement, people are asked to agree with that statement, which in essence asks them to choose between a strong leader or a democracy. I wrote those words sitting right where I'm sitting right now, and I remember a real sense of foreboding, just putting the words into the computer that we might find something pretty grim, and we did. The 40% includes lots of people who say they somewhat agree, and those people could be hedging their bets. But 20% strongly or very strongly agree with that statement. We asked them to make a choice between strong leader and democracy, and they went for strong leader. That's not good news.
Half of over the more than 8,000 people that you surveyed across the country, I mean, literally like roughly half, believe that there will be a civil war within the next several years. Does this go along the same gradient of somewhat to actually strongly believing this?
Yeah, it does. The 50% includes what I've started to call the somewhaters. The people who strongly or very strongly agree amount to less than 20% of the population. But let's say it's one in six adults strongly or very strongly agrees that there will be civil war in the United States in the next few years. That's millions and millions of people. And as we launched this work, you know this, Vicky, I know a lot about gun violence, but political violence was new for us. So I looked at the work of experts, one of whom is in the Washington Post recently, saying these people are preparing for war. We need to acknowledge the reality of the threat and do something about it.
That was going to be my next point, because if you have, you know, half, even somewhat believing that this could take place in the near future, that leads people, when they're thinking about it, to prepare.
That's correct. And actually, one of the criticisms of doing the survey and publicizing the results is by merely bringing the idea to the public's awareness, we may foster other people to prepare. And we talked about that a lot internally. Our decision was, there is a problem. We need to talk about the problem. That's much more important because too many people are simply not paying attention. And what we need to do, those of us who don't want civil war, who renounce violence, is recognize that a fair portion of the population does want and is preparing for those things so that we can counter the threat and not wait for it to appear on our doorstep.
Well, peel back the curtain a little bit more. What conversations took place on the front end to reduce harm while notifying and alerting the public?
We made a deliberate decision to report the findings for those somewhat people, even though they lead to larger percentages. But that has led to, as in this conversation, lots of qualifying about the sort of core level of support. We've made very substantial efforts to get this information to policymakers, to thought leaders. I have an opinion piece out today that talks specifically about the sorts of things such people who can do to reduce the threat. But let me give you an analogy that everybody will be familiar with, COVID. So in late 2019, early 2020, COVID wasn't here yet, but it was really important to talk about it so that we could prepare because it might come, and then in fact it did. We're in that same situation here. We can't ignore the threat as it grows. We have got to talk about it. We have got to organize and respond to it.
Right. And that leads me to another finding in your survey. Roughly a fifth, 20.5%, think that political violence is at least sometimes justifiable in general. However, your research also found a large majority of those who endorse political violence say they're actually unwilling to participate in violence themselves. What comes to the front of my mind is this distinction or potentially lack thereof between participation and enabling.
Yep. I think this is really important and one of several places in this sort of grim landscape of data where we find room for hope. So let me flip it around. 80% of the population says that in general, political violence is never justified. Now, I'm going to take that away a little bit because after we asked the in general question, we asked everybody, well, what about these specific situations? Would it be, we asked 15 of those. And 80% of the population said yes to at least one of those 15 specific circumstances. But most of them said yes to only one. And so we end up thinking that it may well be that support for political violence is basically a mile wide and an inch deep. That most people say never under any circumstances. For those who do, whether in general or in some specific situation, the vast majority say, but I wouldn't want to do it myself. And so I think our task is for those majorities, the ones who say never, ever, and the ones who say maybe, but not me, to recognize there is this small subset who say, yes, it's justified, and I will do it. We haven't yet talked about the people who say, and I'll kill somebody, but I assume you're getting there. But recognize that there is a real threat on the horizon, and do something now. Federal elections are 4 months away. And as I've talked about for a year and a half now, it's a rhetorical question, but I think it capsulizes this pretty clearly. What do we think is going to happen when armed voter suppression, and don't tell me we don't think that's coming, meets armed voter support? We have a chance to intervene before those conflicts arise.
Right. Well, let's get to some of the survey respondents who said that it would be justifiable in some cases to actually kill someone. And that is a fraction of the 20.5% that we're talking about of individuals who think political violence, or those surveyed who believe that political violence is at least sometimes justifiable. So that's less than, 10% of that 20.5. Or no, you're shaking your head. It doesn't work like that.
I'm shaking my head. Yes. So We asked those questions not of the people who said yes in general. We asked those questions of the 80% of people who said yes to at least one of the specifics. So the percentages are of the 80% who said yes. And then in the publication, we extrapolate it to a percentage of the whole population and numbers of people. But we end up with a fair percentage of the population. It is less than 10%, but of the whole population, not of the subset, it's about 7%, who say there's at least some circumstance under which I personally would be willing to kill somebody to advance a political objective. Now, let's say that it's 5%. That's 12.5 million people in the United States who are willing to say to a surveyor, I will kill somebody to advance a political objective. I'm suspecting that most of those people wouldn't actually do it, but still, a huge armed force at the national level is 2.5 million people, globally speaking. And here we have 12.5 million people who say, I'm willing to kill somebody for a political objective. And we asked the question sort of twice because it was so important. So separately, we asked everybody whether they owned a gun or not, whether they espoused political violence in the present or not. In the future, might you be in a situation where you think political violence is justified and with a gun, and what would you do? And about 4% of the group said, I would shoot somebody.
What does that tell us about the collective mentality where we're at in society? Because I think a part of that is also fear, right?
Yep. So at several levels. First off, people buy guns more out of fear than for all reasons put together, which is why we're still in the middle of an unprecedented surge in gun purchasing, because people have lots of things to be afraid of. But it's also clear, and I'm relying on the conclusions of experts on political violence, of which I am not one, who say that much political violence stems from fear or willingness to commit it. Probably the lead example is fear of replacement, the replacement delusion, that there's a conspiracy to replace native-born white Americans with immigrants and people of color, to use the phrasing. Those aren't my words, but that's how it's stated. If I'm afraid of being replaced, I might want to use violence to keep that from happening. So all of that at this moment is inference, but we have those data. We simply haven't done the analysis yet. So in a few weeks, I'll probably be able to talk in much more detail about the motivations behind what we're talking about today.
That survey question that you brought up, that came out to about 41.2% of respondents that agreed that, quote, in America, native-born white people are being replaced by immigrants. What did your survey discover, if any, regarding the role race plays in people's attitude towards political violence?
So we haven't yet done that analysis beyond some individual questions. So I can't talk in detail. But beyond that one, we did find that a surprisingly high percentage, about, again, if I remember correctly, about 40%, said, gave at least somewhat level of agreement to the statement that, I'm paraphrasing, white people face as much discrimination as people of color do. That was higher than I expected to see. We're going to want to look in more detail, look at several questions in combination, look at the demographics. I don't think it's a revelation to anyone to say that racism is alive and well in the United States. I think what we'll be able to report on in more detail is the likelihood, I think, at this point, that racism is motivating some of the political violence that we're reading about. Let me amplify just a bit. So our statement about replacement theory got a 40% support level. While our survey was in the field, the Associated Press came out with a poll that asked it somewhat differently. They said there is a conspiracy to replace, et cetera. So they made it intentional and invoked conspiracy thinking. And they got a 30% endorsement rate with a conspiracy explicitly stated. So let me get really grim with you here. I have not put this in the paper. If I believe in the replacement delusion, if I think I'm being replaced, conspiracy or otherwise, and I don't think that's a good idea, then violence, if I look at the demographics of interpersonal violence, which involve young men of color predominantly, again, this is me speculating, it's much worse than I, Garen, the researcher, have been saying for decades. It's not that I distance myself from that problem because it involves people who are not like me. If I think I'm at risk of being replaced, violence isn't even a problem. It's the solution to a problem. It's eliminating my replacements. Now, we did not ask that question. That is speculation, but it's consistent with the evidence. And it has had me thinking that violence prevention work may face a much steeper hill than we thought, that we may be needing to address the fact that there are many people in the United States who think the violence is on balance, a good thing. It's eliminating their replacements.
This survey was made public before a peer review, however. Why release it ahead of it being evaluated from the medical community and your peers?
So this is not our standard practice. It is an accepted practice when the findings are very urgent and time sensitive. For the last 2.5 years, as an ER doc, I've been relying on material that hasn't been peer reviewed yet, as has the entire medical community, because peer review takes weeks to months and people were dying. There just wasn't enough time. In this case, we've got federal elections 4 months from now, and peer review could take half that time. And we made a deliberate decision, and we're very open about it, to release early. What we did do was send the paper, even before it went up online, to experts in the field and said, take a look at this. Can we send media and people to you for your assessment of the work? So it's peer review without the formal peer review structure. And they've been commenting and they've pointed out, well, gee, we don't know enough. We don't know about partisanship and so on. And that's just coming. But no one has found fault with the methodology.
What's also interesting is the timeliness of your survey, because it was conducted between May 13th and June 22nd, when the House's January 6th committee held its first 4 public hearings. What impact do you believe the hearings might have had on the attitudes of your participants in the survey?
Yeah, I've been shaking my head. I mean, we made the decision to do this survey in December of last year. It takes about 6 months to get a survey rolling, and that's what it took. When the survey was in the field, the Buffalo mass shooting happened, and suddenly the replacement delusion was in the news while people were seeing the survey. More broadly, it's possible that the hearings affected people's responses with regard to some of the questions on democracy. The other is there was the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and maybe more importantly for American respondents, our response to that invasion, which may have affected people's answers about using force to defend democracy, because that's, I think, the U.S. understanding of what's happening in Ukraine. But you can't predict those things. You just have to acknowledge that if the survey were done 2 weeks earlier or later, the results might be a little different.
And we're talking about political violence, and you also specifically study and research gun violence, which, you know, sometimes they can be combined, but they also can be different. In what ways does this survey show how gun violence and political violence is intertwined, and what doesn't it show?
So far what we've done is report just very preliminary questions about the possibility that people would use guns in political violence. In the trove of data we're analyzing, we have very detailed information on firearm ownership, not just yes, no at a personal level, but how many guns and of what kind, and have you bought any recently? Do you own assault type weapons, et cetera? And we will be looking at those data in relationship to questions about willingness to be involved in political violence. One of the things that's been clear just from the, as all of us do, monitoring the rhetoric, is a lot of the rhetoric that's sort of saber rattling that suggests that political violence is a way to solve the nation's problems makes explicit reference to firearms as a way to carry that violence out. That's what drove my concern a year and a half ago, that we were seeing a convergence between support for political violence and rising levels of crime and rising unprecedentedly high rates of firearm purchase. And the question a year and a half ago was, what happens if these trends converge? And that's what motivated the survey to begin with.
There are more firearms than people in the United States, correct?
Correct. 400 million, give or take.
You were quoted in the LA Times a day or two ago saying that we are right now in the middle of a huge national experiment, given everything that we just laid out. Are we too far behind on the curve to get ahead of this?
No. I am a hopeful and optimistic person by nature, but in this case, I think I've got evidence in my pocket. We've talked about some of it, that most people renounce political violence just right across the board. And most of those who are entertaining the thought don't want to do it themselves. I think that's grounds for moving forward. But the darker side of it is this. We are in the middle, rates of fatal violence are higher than they've been in a generation. And we're in an absolutely unprecedented surge in gun purchasing, which is continuing. We have data through June, and it's still continuing.
So last month.
Oh, yeah. The data for a given month are available basically the first working day of the next month. We see spikes like when there's a mass shooting or something, but this started in January of 2020. And now, 2.5 years later, it's still going on. So the sort of alarmist approach to this is this rhetorical question. What happens when you take a society that is very angry at itself, and nobody sees that anger diminishing, and you make guns much more readily available to that society than they were? We have no choice but to live through the experience that will answer that question.
You said the word alarmist, and I think a lot of people that are going to be listening to this, or even just myself reading your survey and taking in the findings, it's hard not to leave and not feel alarmist, yet go on with your life. How do you do that? How do you achieve that on a daily basis?
I've had a lot of practice. I've been doing it for 40 years. I do this. I'm an ER doc. Being passive is simply not an option. I am confronted, and I would argue the nation is confronted, with a huge and complicated problem. I have no option but to do the best I can to address that problem. And that's what I'm posing here. Yes, these results are shocking. There were some very dark conversations among the research team as we started looking at the results. But I argue we don't have the option to stop there. Step one is to get the information done. Step two is to recognize its implications and to be alarmed. Great, fire bell in the night. But step three is we all need to become firefighters. We all need to figure out at an individual level at a societal level how to address this problem, how to address the circumstances that lead to it. The sense of disenfranchisement, of being left behind, of not having an opportunity to participate in this society, which pertains to a lot of this society at the moment. So there are some things we can do quickly, ideally. Tune down the rhetoric. Start talking about violence as a good idea. Thought leaders need to do that because they will get what they ask for. But more broadly, we need, and this is something that other people say with much more knowledge than I have, we need a society that doesn't leave people feeling left out, that gives them a real sense that there are ways other than violence to be heard.
Dr. Wintemute, on that note, thank you so much for the time.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that was my conversation with Dr. Garen Wintemute, director of the California Firearm Violence Research Center and Violence Prevention Program at UC Davis, discussing their nationwide survey gauging Americans' views and willingness to engage in political violence. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's a first of its kind, controversial, and even Governor Newsom thinks the new gun control law will likely end up in the Supreme Court. Gun rights advocates call the new law a cheap political trick, and even the ACLU isn't happy with it. This new gun control law is almost a copy and paste of Texas's recent abortion law, which empowers Californians to sue anyone who sells or manufactures illegal guns, including assault rifles. The law was signed Friday at Santa Monica College, the site of a 2013 mass shooting which left six people dead.
If they're going to use this framework to put women's lives at risk, we're going to use it to save people's lives here in the state of California. That's the spirit, the principle behind this law.
Now, if the plaintiff wins in court, the state will pay them up to $10,000 per violation and per weapon. The law also applies to ghost guns and the parts used to make them. And this is just the latest in a string of gun control bills signed by Governor Newsom. CAP Radio state politics reporter Nicole Nixon joins us with more on this bill and others, which will likely be challenged in the courts. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. First off, if Governor Newsom knows his law will likely head to the Supreme Court, why do it? Is it more about politics and kind of sticking it to Texas, or is there a legitimate teeth to this law?
Well, for Newsom, I think it's both. He said several times that he disagrees with how the Supreme Court decided the Texas abortion case, particularly that it okayed this provision for private enforcement. That was designed as a way to keep that issue out of federal courts. But he said, you know, since these are the rules now, we're going to apply them to firearms here in California to try to reduce gun violence. And Newsom's not the only one who sees this as kind of an in-your-face to Texas. I talked to William Vizard, who's a professor emeritus of criminal justice at Sacramento State, and a former ATF agent. Here's what he said about the new law.
It's not subtle. Rather than a gun regulation, I would view this more as a response of like California legislature to the Texas legislature in what they view as an outrageous abortion regulation.
All right. So can you walk us through Texas's abortion law and what parts of that law Governor Newsom stripped for his gun control law?
Yeah, it's mainly this issue of private enforcement. And just as a refresher, this Texas law was crafted last year before Roe v. Wade was overturned. So last summer, abortion was legal and states could not restrict it before about 23 weeks. The Texas law outlawed it before fetal cardiac activity, you know, around 6 weeks. Instead of having the state enforce it, that law empowered regular citizens to go after anyone who aids or abets an illegal abortion. That includes doctors, abortion funds, or even somebody who drives you to your appointment. And by leaving it up to citizens to enforce in civil court rather than prosecutors to enforce in criminal courts, that Texas law was designed to basically escape invalidation in the courts. All of this is moot now because the Supreme Court has overturned Roe v. Wade and allowed states to restrict abortions. But Newsom and California lawmakers want to use that same legal logic to get around the fact that they do have limited options and resources to find and prosecute people who are selling assault weapons and ghost guns, which are illegal here. So, like you said, this bill is basically a copy paste taken directly from that Texas abortion bill, down to the same dollar amount that you can sue for, which is $10,000 and attorney fees.
I mean, there is a theme here. This concept of private citizens enforcing certain laws around the country, like the Texas abortion law that you just laid out, is it picking up steam? Are we going to see more of this in the future?
It's possible. Oklahoma and Missouri have passed laws similar to the Texas abortion law, including that private enforcement measure. There might be other states as well. New York passed a law last year that allows people to sue gun manufacturers in some cases, but it does not include this private enforcement mechanism. So I guess we'll have to see whether other blue states adopt this as sort of a message bill or whether they wait to see how it plays out in the courts.
I mean, this has gotten criticism, the California law, from Second Amendment advocates to even civil rights advocates. Let's start with Second Amendment advocates. What is their reaction to this law?
Well, a spokesman for the NRA told me in a statement that it's just a political stunt. It's not designed to actually make Californians safer. They say that if that was the goal, state officials might be more focused on preventing crime, which has become a big issue this year ahead of the midterms. And gun rights groups have threatened legal action over this and some other bills, but we have not seen any lawsuits yet.
Well, the ACLU also has come out against this law. On what grounds?
Yeah, the ACLU is concerned about this issue of circumventing judicial review, especially when it comes to constitutional rights. It's basically warning Newsom and the California legislature that in their eyes, the ACLU's eyes, that two wrongs don't make a right. They sent a letter to the governor earlier this year that says it would be a misstep to further entrench this logic that states can just get around sticky constitutional issues by making them enforceable by private parties. I'll read a part of that. It says, quote, California will be promoting a legal end run that can be used by any state to deny an effect. To deny people an effective means to have their constitutional rights protected by the courts. This will continue to be replicated in states across the country and with California's endorsement. So very much concerned about this trend here and the fact that it's gaining popularity.
This latest law is literally the latest in a series that the governor has signed into law for gun control. I mean, just last month, Governor Newsom signed a law to ban ghost guns and to register ghost guns. What exactly does that entail?
Yeah, ghost guns are weapons that arrive in kits and they can be assembled at home into weapons. They often do not have any serial numbers. They're talked about as, a weapon of choice for criminals because it's very hard to track them. And they are already technically banned, but this law expands that ban to include the kits themselves or certain key parts of a ghost gun. And it expands this requirement that people who already have these weapons have a deadline to get them taken in to be registered and an ID mark put on them so they can be tracked. And again, gun rights groups call this duplicative of laws already in place, requiring ghost guns to get that serial number by, I think, 2024.
Another one that has a lot of nuance to it was just a few weeks ago, earlier this month, Newsom signed another law requiring firearm businesses to abide by a standard of conduct and take, quote, reasonable measures to prevent their weapons from falling into the hands of people who would use them illegally. Some could say that that is vague, the language. So how will this law actually work?
Totally. This law is similar to the bill we've been talking about in that it allows people to sue certain gun businesses. The way that it does that, like you said, is to create this standard of conduct for manufacturers and gun shops to implement reasonable controls to prevent guns from going to traffickers, you know, people who aren't supposed to have a weapon because they've been convicted, or even people that, like a salesperson, believe poses a substantial risk of hurting themselves or others. It also allows the attorney general and local prosecutors and people who've been harmed by gun violence to sue those businesses for failing to follow that code of conduct. Like you said, critics say this code of conduct is very overly vague. Also, they have a criticism that, for example, a gun maker might be pulled into a lawsuit for a decision a salesperson made, or vice versa, just a lot of confusing and the gun industry having to be very aware of what all parts are doing.
So why all these laws now?
Well, there's been a frequent mass shootings. Unfortunately, Newsom said at his press conference last week he's tired of attending candlelight vigils, that they don't do anything. And he has also continued to point to data suggesting that as California has implemented gun restrictions, the death rate from gun violence has fallen significantly here over the past couple of decades. Hmm. And it is a political issue now.
Yeah, that brings me to politics. Governor Newsom ran a full-page ad in Texas contrasting Governor Abbott's comments on abortion and the right to life with California's gun control laws and what he says Texas's lax gun laws. Back on July 4th, the holiday weekend, Newsom ran ads on Fox News, which aired in Florida, blasting Governor Ron DeSantis on a host of issues from voting rights to reproductive rights. And the governor keeps pouring, arguably, gasoline on his feuds with GOP governors. What is Newsom's game plan?
Well, Newsom's been getting more vocal nationally about these issues. You know, he was in D.C. a week or two ago calling out Republican governors for, as he says, restricting freedom by banning certain books and topics in schools, restricting abortion, et cetera. He's also been getting more critical of the Democratic Party, saying that it needs to be much more aggressive in fighting against these issues and speaking out against these policies. It's got a lot of people talking about what his plans are for 2024. He is asked about that regularly, and he has the same response every time, which is no. Even if he, you know, there's a lot of discussions about the calculus of whether he would or wouldn't run. I think either way, he is enjoying, you know, poking the GOP governors in other states and getting attention nationally.
An important reminder, he's also up for re-election, and we're less than 4 months until November. Where does the governor stand, and what are we hearing from his GOP challenger, Brian Dahle?
Newsom is talking a lot about these national issues and drawing distinctions in what California is doing on things like guns and abortion with what's happening in other red states. Brian Dahle, who's this Republican state senator in the northern part of the state, is keeping things closer to home. He's really highlighting issues like homelessness, the cost of living and housing prices, and what he says are, you know, California intruding on people's freedoms and ability to get things like guns.
Nicole Nixon is Cap Radio's politics reporter. Thanks for joining us, Nicole.
Thank you.
You can read Nicole's work at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Spencer Day is a critically acclaimed jazz vocalist who also loves musical theater. His rich baritone voice has wowed audiences in large and small venues alike. From piano bars in New York City to an appearance at the Monterey Jazz Festival, Spencer Day delivers a performance that's always uplifting. On his latest album, he reimagines classic Broadway show tunes in a jazz-flavored setting. Our jazz music director, Gary Vercelli, spoke with Spencer Day this spring and began by asking him why he chose this theme.
I think my attraction to Broadway musicals probably started when I was fairly young, just due to their entirely fantastical and escapist nature, because I think, like a lot of kids who don't quite fit in, when they're growing up, I was looking for some place where my flamboyantly large creative tastes might not only be just accepted, but celebrated. And also had kind of a rough family life at home. And so discovering that music could be such a sublime form of escapism to start with was probably how I became a musician. We weren't really allowed to watch. I grew up in northern Utah, and so our access to culture was pretty limited. So it was either Disney movies or MGM musicals, because they were both G-rated and considered wholesome. So I opted for the MGM musicals. So I'd say my love and fascination began back then, and my ability to see how a song, and especially a song that's put in the context of a show, could really transport you into another world, which was of utmost interest to me as an unhappy kid.
Were your parents musical? Did you have music around the house?
I did. You know, my mom, who ended up raising all six of myself and my siblings, she could play Beethoven and was a coloratura soprano. And so even though she was working too much and we really didn't get to study with her, I think her musical talents and abilities definitely must have permeated through the air and reached us.
When did jazz become an attraction to you as an idiom or genre?
The only jazz that we had growing up in rural Utah was the basketball team. So I'd probably say I was about 16 or 17. I came to that a little bit later. And I think first, like a lot of people, probably fell in love with Rhapsody in Blue and then Billie Holiday and Chet Baker. And weirdly, for the record that we just finished recording, I never really listened to Frank Sinatra much, maybe because from very early on in my career, if you're a baritone, you're kind of compared to that. So I really stuck more with the Torch Singers and Betty Carter and Billie Holiday.
I have often walked down the street before, but the pavement always stayed beneath my feet before. All at once am I several stories high, knowing I'm on the street where you live.
Most jazz musicians do make it to the Mecca of New York sooner or later. Was there an attraction enough for you to move to New York City at one point?
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, and the first time I landed in New York, everything about it felt so exotic to me. It was just otherworldly. I could still imagine and see New York in the Charlie Parker era that I wanted it to be. So, yeah, I think for any artist, New York is a pretty life-changing mecca when you finally get to go and see the heights of what musical greatness can be reached there. I lived there for 10 years. So,
what about the struggle from day to day? I know that one of the songs you've chosen to interpret here is What I Did for Love from A Chorus Line. There's a struggle of day-to-day life in New York, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's where the denial and the fantasy of escaping into your Rhapsody in Blue era world is essential. I talked to another friend about that. She's like, we all have to live in our own black and white Woody Allen movie just to deal with the parts of it that are so, so difficult. The whole creative process, the auditioning and all the no's and the rejection, it's like you kind of have to, you have to have a little bit of Norma Desmond delusion in you, I think, to put up with it. I always thought the song was just about what you did for a romantic relationship. And as we recorded it, he explained the real context of how it's a director asking, if you could never dance tomorrow or you could never sing, what would you say to yourself? And for me, my ability to connect with it changed profoundly, because if I look back at all the years spent, and it's such a blessing to do this for a living, but there's so many profoundly lonely moments, so many relationships that you have to give up, because, you know, dating a musician's not for everyone. If people want you home every night. So there's a lot of things I've had to say goodbye to and give up. And as the song lyrics will say, though, I won't regret it.
Kiss today goodbye and point me toward tomorrow. We did what we had to do. Won't forget, can't regret what I did for love.
We're speaking with Spencer Day. He's going to be in concert here in Sacramento. Spencer, one of the interesting choices you made was from Evita, I'd Be Surprisingly Good For You. What's your take on that?
I'd be surprisingly good for you.
I just felt that with that song, that it was a really underrated gem and very harmonically interesting. And during the pandemic, I found myself very accidentally quarantined in Mexico. And while I was there waiting to figure out what was going on with the world, this is very early on, I was able to connect with some really great musician friends I've known there for a while, some wonderful mariachi musicians and flamenco musicians. And since I already happened to be down there, I actually replaced some of the parts we'd originally rehearsed and recorded and said, well, let's go straight to the source. We're in Latin America. So I think you can really hear that on the track. I think it's a really awesome fusion of jazz and then very authentic Latin American musicians.
I won't go on if I'm boring you, but do you understand my point of view? Do you like what you see, what you're hearing? Could you be good? good for me too. I'm not talking of a hurried night, a frantic tumble and a shy goodbye, creeping home before it gets too light. That's not the reason why I got your eye, which has to imply that I would be so good for you. I'd be surprisingly good for you. So good.
One of your label mates on your new record label is Jane Monheit. Tell me about working with her and how you selected a tune from Hello, Dolly.
Well, actually, that was really Jane's idea. She had just seen the production with Betty Buckley. She's just probably the most swinging jazz singer that I know of out there.
What qualities of her voice make a good combination with you as a baritone?
Well, I think if you're singing with someone who's a really sensitive singer, that's the most important thing apart from your ranges is that other person listening. And you both have to be pretty egoless, because in order to get a good blend or mix, anytime I sing duets, you both have to be willing and able to alter your instrument just enough to make the mix really come alive with the other person. And so I think the one thing I appreciate is her ability to really get down and dirty in terms of really understanding what's musically happening rhythmically. And she's just very serious in the studio in a way that I love. She knows exactly what she's doing, and she knows when the take wasn't good and when we got it.
And that is all that love's about.
From a carousel, you chose If I Loved You, and you worked here with Dave Cause. Tell me about how long you've known Dave and what he brought to the project.
We were label mates on Concord Records, and he called me up out of the blue one day and said, "Hi, your record's really great. This is Dave Cause." And I was just like, I know who you are. Hi, I don't know how you got my number, but I'm glad you did. And he's been a huge champion of mine for years. And when I started coming up with this record, I had kind of a wish list of some people I was hoping might appear on it, and I didn't actually know whether they would or not, and both he and Jane agreed, much to my surprise and delight. This track was really fun because he really can play pretty much any genre and any style, and I was just personally very excited to hear what he might sound like on a track that we treated more in a Antonio Carlos Jobim, Brazilian Bossa Nova, Stan Getz sort of style, and it's also one of my favorite tracks.
How I loved you, if I love you,
you've done some impressive work with the Budman Levy Big Band, and you recorded, I guess, with them in the Capitol Studios?
That is correct.
What was it like working in a studio that, you know, Nat Cole and Frank Sinatra had left their DNA in?
Well, I'm very lucky that I didn't just get to be in the room that their DNA is still hovering about, but I actually got to record with, they brought out Frank Sinatra's microphone, almost like it was like a, you know, religious ceremony out of the sarcophagus, which was pretty cool. This little kid of me that grew up where I did still can't believe that I've gotten to do some of these things. I think whenever I get down, which as we know during the pandemic's easy for any of us to do, and start maybe feeling bad about where we think we should be or ought to be, I look at some of these things and I'm still just overwhelmed that I actually got to do it. I got to be in there in the same control booth that Judy Garland and Frank Sinatra and all these people got to be in, and the 20-year-old kid can't believe it. I don't even think the 30-year-old kid can believe it. But you turn around one day and you've done some cool stuff.
Never, never to know how I loved you. If I loved you, if I loved you, if I loved you.
How can you not cozy up to that? I was swaying the entire time. That is Cap Radio Jazz music director Gary Vercelli's conversation with jazz vocalist Spencer Day, which first aired ahead of Spencer Day's performance at the Sophia back in April. Spencer Day is currently on tour in Southern California. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Before we go, a quick editorial note to pass along. We were supposed to speak with Sac Republic FC, the soccer team, about their big match tomorrow night and all the excitement surrounding it, but there was a scheduling mix-up on their end. We will have that interview tomorrow for you on Insight. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We will catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.